Today is our final shiur before Pesach as far as the Sunday class goes. Tomorrow we have the Monday class. And today is a very fascinating shiur, as you will see, and it's right in your ballpark. Today is April 10th, 2016. Sunday afternoon here, Birushalayim HaKodesh, and hello to those in front of me and to many listening across the world. Now, we're dealing here, what's happened with the Mechitza and the changes the minute we came out of the ghetto and all that. We looked at the Western world and we thought it was great and we want to become part of it, and how much can we absorb, and when do we have to know we have to stop? And this question of the Mechitza was a tremendous issue in Moriah Rebbe, as we explained last week, and I gave you very interesting sources. The description of the Rav in Berlin in the 1920s, and the Rav battling for the Mechitza in the 1950s. And there's no question that the Gentile world influenced us. What I recall growing up in New York, when you rode the subways, there was that famous ad, "A family that prays together stays together." And it would show you in the Protestant church, the father, the mother, the son, the daughter, the beautiful family, Avraham, davening together. And it certainly had impact on everyone traveling in the subways. I just want to quote my Talmud rabbi, Dr. Mark Wiener, sent me an interesting note, which I know. He reminded me that originally in Germany, the Reform movement had an organ in the synagogue, but had separate seating. Why did it have separate seating? Because the churches, many of the churches, had separate seating. And he tells me the story. You remember that Mark was a lieutenant colonel and the chaplain in America. When I was on active duty in El Paso, Texas, a German woman came to me to help translate a letter that she received from a friend of hers in Israel in Hebrew. She noticed the mechitz and the chaplain. We got to talk. She mentioned that in her church in Germany, they also had separate seating. And Mark goes on to describe, he saw in some of the big cathedrals that they were originally separate seating. So you see, the organ the Jews brought in, let's debate HaMignish Ma'at, Tshuvot were written, Aron Charon, Lahatir, it's mixed seating, was much harder. That only came later. And the Rav fought, and this whole question that Rav Heschel Schachter is dealing with, it's a very delicate question. Sometimes you can be matir something, you can permit it, but the times don't empower you to permit it. And here I want to go further, and this is a question, a very delicate question. What Rav Heschel Schachter is essentially saying, and of course Rav Menachem Klein said this as well, and it accounts for the Rav's different opinions that I gave you last week from 1926 to 1956. Sometimes you can permit something halachically, but the times are going against it. And here, beginning on page Lamed Dalet in the Bikrei Chatzon, Rabbi Schechter quotes what I didn't live in America, because I'm living here since 69, but I heard about it. And again, I'll tie it together with my own life, something you all know. I believe it was Rabbi Riskin, Steve Riskin, who came up with this idea. I may be wrong, it may be others, but I recall, I'm positive, Rabbi Steve Riskin threw it out. I don't say he threw it out halacha l'maisa, but he threw it out as an idea. The great problem we have with suburbia, and all of you know the story of suburbia, everyone wanted to run away from New York, the air is polluted, you can't find a parking spot, and everyone ran to suburbia, and then too many people ran to suburbia. Today everyone is running back to New York, and ultimately, in every big city, they're going to outlaw ownership of cars. There will come a time that in Jerusalem, you won't be allowed to buy a car, period. Certainly in Manhattan, they've reached that stage already, and there are all types of plans to charge anyone who's not a Manhattanite if he drives in, etc., etc. So now the big problem in suburbia is that everyone lives in a beautiful house with a beautiful plot of land around it, with a pool in his backyard. How many homes can you have within walking distance of the shul? And I have to tell you, when you're younger, you can walk a mile, 2 miles. You grow older, it becomes harder and harder. And you know the word meniscus. I learned that word when I turned 75 and my foot went on me. And the meniscus, and Baruch Hashem, I function, but I can't walk the way I used to walk. So what do you do? So the conservative movement came up with the responsum to permit driving to shul on Shabbat. All right, we've spoken about it many times, many different angles. You all know that some of the thinking conservative people go back to the early 50s when that shiva became halacha lema'asa, and they say that was the end of the conservative movement and its respect for halacha. Fine. But Rabbi Rishkin came up with a different solution. Not that you drive. Tell me, you live in Manhattan, you live on the west side, you live on the east side. You have buildings 80 stories high, 55 stories high. You go into the elevator, the guy, the Gentile is the elevator man, and he knows you, he takes you right up to the floor you want to go. Mutter or not mutter? And this is a well-known shaila. I can tell you the Rav Halacha Lamaisa was matir, if you have Lidva Mitzvah, what does Lidva Mitzvah mean? If you're going, the Rav said on Shabbos, everything you do is Lidva Mitzvah. You're going to shul, you're going upstairs for the Suda, you're going to a Kiddush, you're going upstairs to go to sleep, you're going upstairs to learn. Anything you're going to do on Shabbos is Lidva Mitzvah. So if the elevator man knows what floor and he does everything, the Rav was matir. I know that Halach Lamaisa from cases that came up. Others were matir as well. There were those that insisted you have to live on a low floor, you can't have a miralakam. All right, it's not a simple she'ela. But in Rabbi Lukstein's parish, I can tell you many of the mitpalalim are somech lahakel on the elevator man. No, Rabbi Rishkin says, why not have a bus service on Shabbos? And the buses will pick you up, and they'll know where to deliver you. For the sake of argument, people live in Englewood, people live in Teaneck, in suburbia, people live in West Hempstead. You have an easy solution. A bus that makes the rounds, he knows where to go, everything is worked out in advance, it's not part of Shabbat, he comes to Shabbat, he knows he has to stop at this corner, that corner, he knows where the shul is. What is wrong? I haven't said a word yet, Moshe, what can you be asking? You and Rabbi Rubin both suffer from Sovereignitis. It's unbelievable. You caught it from Rabbi Rubin. Relax. We're going to get there in a few minutes. No, hold on. Yitzchak, relax. I'm going to get to his question, and you should recognize it in a second. So you know, Rabbi Peshel Shachter said, correctly so, that sometimes it's not pure halacha. You have to take in considerations the surroundings in which this question is asked. And for us to be matir, a bus being driven by a goy on Shabbos, going around, it is absolutely not advisable and not viable. It can't be worked out bisman hazeh. People will say, a guy this, that, before you know it, you'll have a guy turning on the radio, turning on the television. You don't even need a guy. You have a time clock. No, the shaila I got when in BMT, these kids on Shabbos used to go crazy, the football game of the week. There was one kid I had from a very wealthy family in the Midwest, and a basically a firm family. And they were well-to-do, they had a big factory. And I remember this kid told me that the goyim who worked for them tape video, it was primitive videoing, but it was beginning already in the 70s, the game going on, the football game, and after Shabbos they make tens of copies for the whole family, and Shabbos morning is shul, they give it out. Every part of the family, someone is there, and he gets the game that they miss Shabbos afternoon. So you understand yourself, if we're going to be matter a bus, picking up people, driving them to shul, technically maybe it's not Chilul Shabbos, but it's a total abolition of the spirit of what Torah is about. Now, I have to tell you, and this takes me back to something I've spoken about so many times over the decades. This was exactly the She'ila in Russia. In January of 1981, when I reached the Soviet Union for the first time, and you know, today you talk about communist Russia, no one comprehends what you're talking about. Life moves on, it has to be that way. It's like I just told, I just spoke with the Lower Merion. So I told my Talmud there that the other day in the Shtiblach, Rabbi Rund, Donny Rund, who runs the Shtiblach, says there's someone davening, I don't know who it is, someone walked in, a tourist. Anyway, Ani is friendly, and he says, you're from Lower Merion. Do you know who's sitting here? He was your second rabbi, if I'm not mistaken. This guy looked at me, couldn't care less. It's so many years, I was rabbi there, 61, 62, he wasn't alive then, he couldn't give a hoot. You know, I figured this young man should have some intellectual curiosity. Who are you? What's your name? When were you there? What was it like? Nechtek a tug. He didn't give a hoot. So when you talk about communist Russia, unless you were there, you can't understand what it was like. Believe me, even Yomo does not comprehend what yours truly and Rabbi Rubin comprehend. So, as you know, in every community, there was one, I'm using a KGB terminology now, one functioning synagogue. You've heard that term, functioning. And the KGB was very smart. They shut down all the shuls and all the churches, primitive idol worship. I remember a very famous refusenik said to me, I couldn't believe my ears, she said to me, Professor Akefich, you're so intelligent, how could you believe in such stupidity like religion? I looked at her, and this was said to me in Israel when she was living in Ramat already. All right. But one shul, one church, they let function, because there were old babushkas that want to go pray. And in every shul, in every church, they had KGB agents. In Jewish shuls, it was Jews. What they used to do in the shuls, the KGB agents would get bored and tired, so they'd wait until they leave, and then they'd have a kiddush with a little vodka, and their hearts would open up. Particularly, there would always be a shtibble on the side with the real old-timers, and the KGB really didn't give a hoot because these people were going to die out. That's why the law was in Russia, if you want to teach children over 18, you cannot teach them in Russian. You can only teach them in Yiddish. You understand? Because most kids already didn't know Yiddish that well. Russian was their native language, but you can only teach in Yiddish. All right, Baruch Hashem, we survived them. So now you have the Baal Tshuva movement in Russia. Now remember, you always have to differentiate. Chabad was always there. Rafi, Chabad is not a Johnny come lately. Chabad was Meis and Nefesh in Russia, as I suggested, and someone took up my suggestion from Australia. I'm waiting to see the final product, that some Chabadnik should do a volume on all the Chabadnikim who were killed or exiled for Chabad Satorah, including the seventh Rebbe's father. And all these people, either they were executed or they died young. To survive Siberia was not an easy matter. So they wanted Davin. The other Balei Tshuva, who are a result of the refusenik community, want to go to the shul. So they came up with a tremendous system. And I'll never forget, they showed it to me. In order to go on to the metro in Russia, you had to go through a gate which had lights. Red, green. Okay? But you could pay in advance and buy a monthly card. You could sew the card on to your coat underneath the lapel. and you would walk past the woman who sat there, seeing that you prayed, you flip, and you don't have to go through the red-green. You walk on the side because you have a monthly card. And even for a Shabbat, where let's say April 1st was on Saturday, so you'd have two cards, one for Friday night, a March card, and one for Shabbos morning, for the new month. No, it's a beautiful question. Now, don't tell me that your weight adds, you know, this is Shiloh with elevators, that your weight adds to the motor, has to work harder. I'm not postulating la halacha, but
just assume the people are living far away.
Oh, yeah, we're talking in Moscow. Moscow is massive. And there's one shul in the center. It's a 12-minute walk from the Kremlin. But Moscow is massive. But the metro is fabulous. In other words, the metro is like a clock. And no matter where you live, there's spokes. You can come into the center. All you do, you take a metro around the side, and then you connect with the center. The metro system in Moscow, under the communists, was under military control. And the military worked in Russia. Not much else worked. In my time, I don't know today, it was 1,000 times better than the New York subway system. And remember, the New York subway system grew up hodgepodge, three different subways, all getting you into Manhattan. In Moscow, it was planned. It was under Stalin in the 1930s. They named it in memory of Lenin. And it was planned to cover all of Moscow. So you can go anywhere with the metro in Moscow. No, it's a good shaila. So I want to tell you, rumors had it, and I can't substantiate it. I have a feeling it may be partially true, that both Reb Moshe and Reb Ruderman of Baltimore were matir, but they didn't want to put it into writing. When I got there, there were real balei tshuva headed up by Reb Elia Essas, and they wanted me to ask Rav Shlomo Gorin, but I think because I gave lectures on the Rav and they saw how devoted I am to my Rebbe, so they said, when you go back to civilization, we want you to ask the Rav and Rabbi Gorin if we can use the metro on Shabbos. And you see, it was exactly very analogous to Rabbi Riskin's proposal with the bus picking up the people. Here you have a metro that's running anyway. You get in, you don't have to walk through lights, you pay in advance, you're not telling anyone anything. The fact that there are 102 people in the car instead of 100, big deal. This was the metro system of Moscow was world famous. By the way, it was very far down, built on purpose to survive bombings. During World War II, everyone went underground. It was better than the London system, where they also went underground, but it was not as far under. The metro of Moscow was really flights and flights underground. So the Rav told me, I'll never forget, and he almost with tears, and you could hear in his voice, with all my compassion, with all that I understand, we can't be matir this, Bisman Hazeh. See, it's exactly what Rabbi Shachter says. To be matir this, we become like the conservatives. Rabbi Gorin, I went to see on a Friday morning, and I don't want to elaborate, it was a very difficult Friday idea. He was a nervous wreck, because that was the Friday the Zim line had crashed, had sunk, I think, off Mexico, and there were bodies that were never recovered, and Agunot, I know the problems, I don't know much, but in the field of Agunot, Lo Amoritz Anochi, I know exactly what was going through his mind. But I went in, and I had this appointment, and he starts yelling at me, he's shouting at me. It was on Rehov Keren HaYesod, an apartment owned by the government for the chief rabbi, yelling, what are you, Mata, Rabbi Conservativi, Mama, tell me, Jim Shrav Salavation, come, I am Conservativi, he was yelling. And so when I came out, his wife was worried, you know, she was upset for me. I was a big boy already. You can yell at me from today to tomorrow. I knew exactly where I am and what I'm dealing with, and I understood Rabbi Goren. So she sat me down and brought me, I remember, coffee and cake, and I showed her my pictures. She was very interested in the pictures. The pictures did make a big impression, not only upon her, but upon Moshe Sharon, all of Agudat Yisrael, but that's a separate story. Some of those pictures are right in that book you're holding, and they're also in the book that the Mossad put out, B'netiv HaDemama. So you see, Rabbi Schechter is right on here. And not everything can you be matir. You have to understand the circumstances, the surroundings, and it could be, and here he mentions, I'm quoting Rabbi Schechter here, that there's certain concepts in worship of God that were once very acceptable. For instance, a matseva. You built a matseva, you had the trees near the synagogue. Later, there are people, you're not allowed to build a matseva. The Akadid Goyim do it. It's idol worship. If you do it, they'll suspect you're an idol worship. There were synagogues that didn't allow trees. We have a carryover. New, who can tell me? Shavuot. Who decorates their shul on Shavuot? Right or wrong? Some people, you go into a shul and shvut, you have a florist, but if you follow minhag hagra, you're not allowed to have decorations. That's like Easter wreaths, it's goyim, it's Christmas wreaths. Who ever heard of bringing flowers into a shul? So you see, he makes the point that we are influenced by outside circumstances. And this is true about every posek. That's why psak, you have to know who the person is, what the question is, what the surroundings are. And Reb Heschel has now about to complete this long tshuva. Okay, now let's bring it down to earth. We're on page Lamed Vav in the Ikvei Hatzon. How old was Reb Schechter at the time? Make the chishuv.
56?
Let's assume this. We're talking 84, 1984.
He was born.
He was born 42. He's 75 today. He's 75. He's 75. He's 3 years younger than I am. 75. So let's make the cheshbon. 75, let's go back to 1984. That's about
42.
Early 40s. Tell me, in our world, when do you become a Gadol Hadar? How old was Rav Shach when the Litvisha world swirled around him? Okay, just think. Rav Shach died well over 100. How old was Rav Alyashiv when the Litvisha world... In our world, you don't open your mouth in public until you're 80 years of age. And at the age of 80, you're still considered a youngster. Right or wrong? Think for a minute. Rav Steinman, how old is Rav Steinman? Say he's 100 years old. How old is Rav Kanievsky? I'm talking the Litvisha. High 80s, at least. Who are we talking about? The Rav, when all is said and done, had one factor going for him. He was an enagel of Rav Chaim. And in that level already, it's like a Hasidic Rebbe. In other words, what you just said, you took the words out of my mouth. In the Hasidic world, it's not like that. In the Hasidic world, just think in 1966, when the 18-year-old young man, Rabbi Yisachar Dovro Kach, got married to the Vishnus Rebbe's daughter, Chassidim in their 80s stood before him, Chassidim on the wall of Shas, backwards and forwards by heart, Chassidim who never sinned in their lives, who survived the Holocaust, who survived Mapai in Israel. And they stood before this youngster holding a kos and wouldn't drink until the young kid said to them, L'chaim. See, that's Chassidus. That's Chassidus. The Lubavitcher Rebbe became Rebbe in 1951. All right, you can say 1950, actually, but really in 51. 1950, the Rebbe was born 1902. So he was 48, all right, but he, you know, let's not minimize the man who kolator kulabal peh, and he was a big shnius in yichus, if I understand the law of the previous rabbi, but that's in the Hasidic world. It doesn't go in our world. So here, Rabbi Heschel Shechter wrote this tshuva, but he senses a long paragraph here. Who am I? What am I? How do I have the right to open my mouth in public? But he quotes the Gemara in Chagiga, Shebabinatuto, Sherebskaya, Benakulis, Chachivet, Beitainu, the whole story with the carbon, it's in Sechet Gittin as well, in Hanazikin, the whole story of the carbon that the Chachamim should have looked the other way, moved it sideways, and instead he spoke out. Sometimes when you're too modest and you're too careful, you destroy the Beis HaMikdash. He said, what's happening now, we have to speak out. What's happening now, it has reached major proportions, and everyone claims that it's a new world, there's a new tomorrow, the young rabbis are clamoring, and people think that all the graduates of yeshivas, Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan, he says this, and all the rabbis in the Rabbinical Council of America think this way, and the time has come that we must make our position clear, or there will be Churban HaBayit, the Beit HaMikdash will be destroyed, Yiddishkeit will be destroyed, Torah will be forgotten, in our language, orthodoxy will be negated, abrogated, nihilated, overrun, etc. So here, at the end of the tshuva, he has an appendix. This appendix is very important, and it's been discussed and analyzed 1,000 times over. Every book that comes out on Orthodoxy today, there just was a book by our Talmud from this very kollel, Rabbi Dr. Adam Fraser. Fraser, do I have the last name correctly? Adam. Fersica. Rabbi Dr. Adam Fersica. I'm waiting for the book. It's going to be delivered to me in due course by Rabbi Reuven Unger. We'll get a chance to see it. I read a review of it in Makor Rishon. Remember I quoted in class that he says exactly what I've been saying here about outreach, about Lakewood, about all that's happened. What Lubavitch began has affected every branch of Torah Judaism today. But as Rakefet puts it, the Lakewood outreach is the concept of a kollel, a community kollel, Talmud Torah. The Chabad outreach is the value of getting a Jew to do a mitzvah, to add one more mitzvah to his credit, to the Jews' credit, to the world's credit. It's outreach, but two different vantage points, or slightly different vantage points. Be it as it may, everyone views this as the document that describes the swing to the right in Yeshiva University. And every discussion, every dialogue, any article, any book, any reference you will see today about why you moving right wing, Chovevei Torah counter-reaction to the swing to the right. And all that has happened goes back to this addendum at the end of the tshuva. And what he does here, yes.
Schechter was one of the junior Rosh Yeshiva at that time.
No, Seid, I'm going to come to relax.
I just want to know there must have been a whole bunch of other right?
Boy, that Savlonitis is that whole last row here is suffering today.
It's what happens when you grow up in New York City.
In New York City, you say, all right. But Savlonitis, I've been with Yedoli Israel. Patience, they'll get there. And the way he puts it is magnificent. He now puts in a document, an official document. We have been asked a question by Rabbi Eliezer Zalman Bernstein Sheyichya, the president of the Rabbinical Council of America. Now, the mere fact that he mentions Rabbi Louis Bernstein is itself very, very wise, very intelligent, because it's conveying a message. Rabbi Louis Bernstein, who we all knew very well, you were in his congregation in Bayside, I taught his children. He was a dynamo. Rabbi Louis Bernstein is the only rabbi in the history of RCA to be elected president 3 different times, if my memory is correct. His doctorate is on RCA. It's a very valuable doctorate, published in the mid-60s. It's going to be very valuable in the Monday class when we go into the history of the rabbinate in America. The reason it's so valuable is all the documents he quotes was subsequently lost. RCA moved from office to office, and each time you move, you have to condense. And they threw out all these documents. We have to be very thankful for his doctorate because it preserves the early dynamic history of RCA. Now, Rabbi Louis Bernstein was not a right-winger, by far. He was the one, whenever you read the accounts of the period, the Synagogue Council controversy, he was the combatant of Rabbi David Hollander. If one was Joe Louis, the other one was Joe Wolcott. I don't know who fights for the heavyweight title today, but in my youth, that was the big heavyweight battle. David Hollander, and they were both Talmidim of the Rav. David Hollander was one of the earliest Talmidim of the Rav. Rabbi Louis Bernstein comes along a little later. Rabbi David Hollander was, if I'm not mistaken, a brother-in-law to Rabbi Moshe Scherer. They were married to sisters, okay? I'm not mistaken, I'm right. They were married to sisters. Rabbi David Hollander was not an agudist. He was a big Mizrachiite, 100%. But Rabbi David Hollander was right-wing, you would call, in popular language. And he insisted the RCA has to leave Synagogue Council, and Rabbi Soloveitchik agrees with him. Rabbi Louis Bernstein was on the other end of this coin, the syndrome, the other side. He insisted we have to remain in Synagogue Council. What unites us is much more important than that which divides us. And he also claimed, this is what Rabbi Soloveitchik said, at every last rabbinical convention, RCA, they fought with each other round after round after round. In the 54, I think it was, David Hollander scored a tremendous victory, and he was elected president of RCA. And here I'll tell you something off the cuff. The rabbis, I believe that convention was held in Detroit. You can check it out. If not, I'll deal with it. I have all the facts in front of me in my notes. I believe it was in Detroit. I may be wrong, but it's not in New York. And there was a plane flying back with all the rabbis on it. I heard this from Rabbi Bernard Berzon. You remember Beryl Berzon? And he had a good sense of humor. He said they were so depressed on the plane that Rabbi Hollander won out. What's going to be with RCA, and it'll move to the right. And they said, you know, maybe we'll be better off. This is Beryl Berzon. When they're on the plane, where the plane should crash and we should all go, we won't have the Akmas Nefesh. And then after he introduces this to the rabbis, he starts in preaching. Could you imagine what the headlines will be in New York's newspapers? New York Times, full page headline, 50 prominent New York Orthodox rabbis are missing. And they were laughing and crying. But it gives you an idea of the feeling. Then David Hollander went out, but RCA survived his viewpoint, and Rabbi Bernstein was elected president. And I got to give credit, I knew both Rabbi David Hollander and Rabbi Louis Bernstein very well. And they were two great guys. They could not be bought off. They were not, these guys were sincere. They, at times, were a little off the wall. Their balabatim were not the happiest with their activities way beyond the shul. I once met the man who had been president for many years of Rabbi Bernstein's shul. I said, boy, you had a great rabbi. So a balabas, he says to me, yeah, he was a great rabbi when he was traveling and not in the shul. But when he was in the shul, you know, he was always busy with politics beyond. But, you know, this is a catch-22 in the rabbinate. The balabatim want the rabbi to be famous. It gives the shul shtolpskite. Wow, everyone knows them, knows their rabbi. On the other hand, when the rabbi is too busy with other matters, they're complaining he's not devoting himself to the shul. But you see, Rabbi Bernstein turns to the yeshivas, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan faculty, to the Rashi Yeshiva, as president of RCA, and he's asking them, what should be our position? And according to Rabbi Bernstein's question, in some Orthodox synagogues, they have hakafat and simchat Torah, where the women carry the Sefer Torah. In other synagogues, they have separate prayer groups for the women, for Kriyat HaTorah, for Kriyat HaMegillah. Is this forbidden or is this permissible? And Reb Heschel quotes the answer that they gave, summarizing everything we have spoken about, that these are changes, you're playing with the synagogue, you're emulating the Gentiles, women cannot say Kaddish, cannot say Kedusha, and Chukat HaGoyim, and we absolutely can't permit any of these practices, and in shuls where this has begun, it is Mehanachon Levatlan Mikan Ula Haba. The Davar Yadua, and it's well known, that the two gedolei hador of our generation, that all of us and all the members of RCA listen to, Moreno Hagon, Reb Yosef Dov, Shalevi Salavetchik Shlita, Moron Hagon, Reb Moshe Feinstein Shlita, Shneihem mitnagdim ma'od l'chol ha'inyanim hanal, to all these practices. And excuse me? What? Moshe, what are you saying?
I missed the year that this was written.
The 1984. This is the same. This is based upon Yutet Lechodesh Kislev Yutet. Very interesting. Tashma. So it has to be 1984. 84, 85, 1984. And yes, the Rav, as I told you, and Reb Moshe, both of them, it's absolutely true, that even though many of these practices you could justify halachically, you could be matir, but they were not happy to be matir. The times were such, they were on a slippery slope, feminism and all that was taking place. What's very fascinating here, who signed this tshuva? And in page Lamed Zayin, you will see five names. These are all people that I knew or know intimately. Nisim Lippa Alpit, Zvi Schechter, Abba Brandspiegel, Mordechai Willig, Yehuda Parnas. Gentlemen, what you see here is a shifting of the gods. Can you do me a favor? You know how to turn it on? Just turn it on. I set it at 22. You see here a shifting of the gods. And this is inevitable. No one lives forever. No one is in his prime forever. I meet people and they look at me. You can make it. Fine. It's perfect. I meet people and they look at me, what, you're still teaching? It's like, it's a crime for someone my age to be teaching. So I answer them, if I wouldn't be teaching, I wouldn't be alive. What can I tell you? But I'm no dummy. I understand the shifting of the gods. Tell me, Yitzchak, what name is missing from here? Just think for one moment. Moreno Rabbeinu, or Yosef Dov HaLevi Salavetchik.
But was he not well by that time?
So, I want to tell you, when this tshuva originally appeared, and it appeared before the article, B'kvei Chatzon, Everyone asked why the Rav didn't sign. The leftist said, and I'm using popular language, he didn't sign because he didn't agree with them. The rightist had a different answer. In my humble opinion, and remember, I wasn't living in America in 85, I already was living in Israel for many years. I was far from the scene. But I did visit with Rebbe in 1983. My own feeling is that they recognize the Rav already was far from his prime. The Alzheimer's was hitting home. There were days when he was sharp. There were days when he was not sharp. He was very slow. When I sat in the shir in 83, I was amazed how slow he went. You understand what he said back in 58, in 20 minutes, took him 2 full hours. There were days when he simply was, they would say, they could feel he was slightly out of it at that time. It's a sad reality. My own feeling is the fact that his signature is not there only indicates that those closest to him realized he was not ready to go to battle. They didn't want to bring him into battle. This already was the Torah world moving into the post-Rabbi Soloveitchik era, just as shortly thereafter it moves into the post of Moshe Feinstein era in 1986. And as you know, the Rav already lived another, he died in 1993, so it's practically another 9 years. But from 85 on, he was totally out of it, never returned to New York. Already in 84, 85, I always tell people, people ask me why I'm so loyal to the Rav's Talmidim who came from all the yeshiva in New York and were all right-wingers. And I'm not a right-winger like they are. I have a different hashkafa. I'm more in the Rav's world. Not in their world where they took, as the Rav said, they take my world as far as learning, but not beyond, not with the hashkafa. But I'm very loyal to them. I admire them because they stayed with the Rav during very difficult times. Rabbi Lichtenstein himself told someone who lives not far from here in Beit Vagan, when he wanted to send his son to learn by the Rav, because he had learned by the Rav, and he was a good Talmud in the 50s. And Rabbi told him, keep your son here, he can gain more here with his Rebbein today. The Rav is not the Rav you recall, that you remember. So lo aleinu, we all have to be humble, this is part of life. So I don't take the fact that the Rav's signature is not here as being indicative that he disagreed, not at all. Now, the name of the names that are here, Rabbi Albert, for instance, Rabbi Albert was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He was married to the granddaughter of Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg. For a brief time, his son-in-law was a member of this very kollel, Rabbi Binyamin Blau. Unfortunately, his wife left him. That's a story unto itself. It's not for now. Rabbi Albert, if you knew him personally, was one of the sweetest Talmidei Chachamim you could ever meet. A Yid, a Lamdan, a Posek, and just a Zis human being, a sweet human being. Rabbi Abba Brandspiegel, tomorrow there'll be a student here in class, Mark Watson. Mark Watson is a Talmud of Rabbi Abba Brandspiegel. Abba and I grew up together in the Bronx. Abba was a survivor, survived with miracles. His grandfather, when his grandfather walked into the room of the Gerer Rebbe, the Re'em, Rabbi Avraham Mordechai Alta, the Gerer Rebbe stood up for him. His grandfather was the Re'em, that was the third Gerer Rebbe, one of the most famous, the son of the Sfat Emet. He was Rabbi Avraham Mordechai's Melamed Dar Deki. He He taught him Chumash and Rashi and Mishnah and Gemara. It was his Rebbe of his youth. Abba came from a tremendous Hasidic family. As I recall, he went to high school in Tera Vadas. He was a Bronx boy. And then he came to Yeshivas for B'Skol Chanan. And there's no question that he was one of the greatest Talmidim of the Rav. When the Rav switched to English, and remember, I'm an ear witness to how this, an eye and an ear witness. The Rav was sitting here, and I was sitting here, and Danny Grant is standing right over there. And I told you 1,000 times over, Danny Grant says to the Rav, it's 1960, September, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you are withholding Torah from Jewish boys. I didn't know that Danny Greer knew the Rav. His father was in the diamond business, even though his father was Egyptian. He knew Yiddish and was one of the founders of Morias. I didn't know that Danny. I thought he was a chutzpan, was ready to smack his face. But the Rav is listening. The Rav says, what do you mean? What do you mean? And he tells the Rav, Rebbe, I don't understand Yiddish. I graduated Princeton and I took off a year. I want to learn Torah. All right, that's all the Rav had to hear. He graduated Princeton. What, that's an Ivy League college. And he wants to learn Torah. So the Rav, this was Tuesday, the Rav says to Danny, tomorrow I will give the shiur in English. And I'll give you Abba Chiner after the shiur. And we'll see what you understand. And the next day, excuse me, I'm telling you word by word. Wednesday we come into class and the Rav begins the shiur in English. Oh, it was difficult. And the Reb Chaims and the Chipsa, the Gavra, and everything with English terminology, German terminology, unbelievable. Rav is inventing words. There's a word for that, by the way, in Webster's, I forget, but there is a word. What's the word? Where you invent words.
Neologisms.
What's it called?
Neologism.
What is neol? What does that have to
do? Neologism.
Neologism. Thank you. Write it out for me. That's very interesting. Neologism. Boy, if I knew Russian the way he knows English, I'd really be successful in life. Alex, and well, right, but we know English a little bit, so we're blown away. Abba Braunschweiger was boiling mad. Because his native language was Yiddish. He received the Torah in Yiddish. His parents grew up in Yiddish. They were all survivors. His brother, who was a photographer, who changed his name to Brown, he died young, Abraham Brown. I told you, and I did a Chesed Shalemet in the Rav, there's a picture Tova Lichtenstein gave me that his brother took in Maria, and I write in the picture who it was taken by. I write Brown, and in parentheses, Braunschweiger. You should know that he was Abba's brother. Abba remained at heart a Torah Vadas boy. He wasn't already as broad as Rabbi Albert. He remained a Torah Vadas boy. And the Rav told Abba, and everyone laughed when this was mentioned at the Shloshim, and Abba Braunschweiger eulogized the Rav every night at different, during the Shloshim, every night at different Rosh Yeshiva at YU spoke in the Beis Medrash, in the Harry Fisher Beis Medrash, which was the only Beis Medrash then. Everyone spoke about the Rav, and Abba spoke how the Rav encouraged him to get a doctorate in Bernard Revel Graduate School. And the audience was laughing, because they couldn't envision Abba Braunschweiger getting a doctorate. He was not a tipus that fit into that. He was a wonderful Rebbe in the yeshiva, very sensitive, very caring. And not just a Talmud Chacham Muflakim. There are many Talmud Chachamim running around, but to be a Rebbe, you have to be a caring, sensitive individual. He was a wonderful Rebbe. And then time marched on, and Abba leaves for Landa College. And he was convinced. I remember meeting him in Borough Park, and he was rabbi of Agudat Yisrael in Borough Park, and taught it, and he was Rosh Yeshiva at Landa. And I remember Abba saying, Ani, you got to come into my house. And he had a copy of Rabbi Lamb's book, Torah Lishma. And he underlined sentences. Do you agree with this? Do you agree with this? I could see he was so angry.
What year was it?
He left for Landa College. Whenever Go Chip, when Landa College began.
Roughly? I mean,
Not abruptly, but at the end.
Roughly, I'm saying 1995.
Land the college. Let me think back. It has to be in the 1990s. Yeah, you
may be.
After the Rupp passed away, the Rupp was no longer active. It has to be mid 90s, early 90s. Land the college. He left. Now, then on the next line are two other Rashi Yeshiva. One of them you know very well. Some of you studied with him, Harav Mordechai Willig. And that's the Willig family was a very fabulous family that survived the perils of living in, his part of the family was in England and America, and they remained, the heart of the family remained from. And Morty Willig, there are many members of the family, but he by far is the biggest Talmud Chacham, a posek of Beitin of the RCA, rabbi of the Young Israel of Riverdale, and a very solid individual, very much in tune with Rav Heschel Shechta, both of them Talmidim of the Rav. Both of them, you know, certainly you cannot say that Rav Heschel or Rav Mordechai are Torah Vadas boys. They're a little broader. I'm sure they both have master's degree. I know Rav Heschel has one. I'm sure Morty has a master's degree. And he signed on. The fifth name was one of a very fascinating individual, Harav Yehuda Parnas, Teddy Parnas. He too left with Rav Heschel to go to land the college. And Rav Heschel, I believe, was offered but didn't go. Excuse me. Thank you for correcting me. He too left with Rabbi Braunspiegel to go to land the college. Now, Rav Parnas was a very fascinating individual. He was a person who was always thinking. I've been very close to him over the generations, particularly in the 50s into the 60s. He, you know, people who knew him, he was just a run-of-the-mill YU Mizrahi-type individual. And over the years, he thinks and he's challenged. He never took anything for granted. He was a fabulous Rebbe. Again, more than just a Talmud Chacham, very sensitive, very caring, someone that really understood the world. And he told me he chose to wind up in the Lakewood sphere, the Litvische sphere, but he was quite open and could understand the YU world from where he grew up, where he came from. He was a Talmud, I believe he studied just with Reb Moshe Shatzkis, and of course he studied with the Rav, and these were all upright, thinking, very people who did not take life for granted. They didn't run with the ball because this is what everyone is doing. And these five individuals, led by Rav Heschel, came out with this psak that they all agreed to. Al zeh banu ha-chatam yom hei l'seder v'yeshev yutet l'chodesh kislev. Interesting, if they recognize the importance of that day, tashma. Gentlemen, this document becomes crucial in all research that has subsequently been done, all research that people are involved with, the evolution of Torah on the American scene. Hold on 1 second. I'll end off in 1 second this part of the lecture. If I can go back to my own scholarship, in my second volume, The Sylvie Era, which is an interesting story how I got involved in writing it, because the truth is you don't need two doctorates. And the Sylvie Era may even be more profound than Bernard Revel, my original doctorate. But how I got involved in writing it, I'll share with you the story very briefly, was in my research on Rabbi Revel, I became very close to Rabbi David Silva, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rabbi David Silva was the son of Reb Lazer Silva, and he graduated the yeshiva. He was a Talmud of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, of Rabbi Revel, and he was very helpful to me in my research on Rabbi Revel. He left the yeshiva, went to Harrisburg, and he remained there, I believe, for 65 plus years, rabbi in Harrisburg. So Zoni Shtela. You never met a finer gentleman. He was the opposite of his father. His father, Ablazer, was volatile, sharp, could get angry in a moment, could blow up, could be your best friend. I know the personality. That was Reb Lezer. Reb David was the calmest, finest rabbinic figure you could ever meet. Talmud Chacham, but a man, if you had to consult on a pastoral problem, he was the man, he was the rabbi. Raised wonderful children in Harrisburg, Kol HaKavod Lo. So I became quite close to him. And he contacted me. He was here in Israel, and he says, look, I have my father's archives. I'll Xerox it for you. Maybe you want to publish something. So I couldn't resist to look at Reb Lezer Silver's archives. I said yes. And he did Xerox it all. I told him not to edit. I don't want. He said, no, I'll Xerox everything. And he sent it on to me. And before I know it, I was involved in research. It took 10 good years of research. I mean, I'm teaching 2 full-time jobs plus. And the Silver Era. Now, the Silver Era may be my most famous volume, whatever the reasons are. Now, I have there a chapter that's been quoted and requoted. As a matter of fact, in a critique of the Silver Era in the archives, they state that it's the most important chapter written on Orthodoxy in America. It's the chapter post-World War II Orthodoxy. And I describe to you what happened after World War II. We're going to talk about this in a different context altogether in a few weeks' time when we deal with the Rav's concepts of feminism, etc. And I want to use Harry Epstein's life, the Rabbi of Atlanta, as a basis for why the Reb said what he said, etc., as you will see. So that chapter becomes very important. But I have to tell you, this tshuva and 1985 and these names, it's an addendum. It totally outdates what I wrote about. In other words, I bring you up to date through the 1960s. From that point on, I can't engage in scholarship because I'm opinionated. I lived it. I have emotions. It's like if they would know today in Bernard Revel Graduate School, if Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander would know that Rabbi Revel is my cousin, I could have never been assigned a doctorate because common sense tells you how can Rakefit write about his cousin if he's prejudiced, it's his cousin. When you're going to do scholarship, you have to be willing to start from scratch and be subjective. Now, there is a way to write scholarship. If you find something off color, you don't have to give all the details, but you can't leave it out. You just have to know how to handle it in dignity. With 1985, this begins a new era. And everything in life is a slow motion process. But there's no doubt in my mind that all the historians and all the social scientists and all the political scientists are absolutely right. This tshuva made public to Rabbi Louis Bernstein, who is not a right-winger, and the thoughts that they express, you can understand. This shows a shift. Why you, at least the rabbinic faculty, has taken a more right-wing stand, or call it mainstream, but they are not happy with innovation. This tshuva, when Jaffa is organized, one of the motivating factors for the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Association is this very tshuva. It struck at their hearts. And Jaffa begins, you should know, very small. Then there's the incident which we've spoken about in Hillcrest, Queens. And again, that empowers Jaffa. It's a major organization with many split-offs and different names today. Porat, call it what you wish. And you know what happens in Queens. I told you more than once, my classmate, Rabbi Rothberger, his daughter, which is bar mitzvah age, his wife had been in a terrible car accident, and until today, she cannot walk properly. And these are very good people. And she was a bit of a feminist, and her daughter reaches bat mitzvah. She wants the girl. By the way, her two, I believe both her brothers studied here in the Kollel. And she was, feminist tendencies, wants the girl to read the Torah. And Rabbi Simcha Kraus, Chaim Berlin graduate, who also has moved, using popular language, to the left over the decades, is very happy to give her the Torah. And a tremendous outcry takes place, led by some of the very names that just were that I just read to you who signed on. And they make a tremendous issue that this should not come about. The Queen's Rabbinate has a vote that's overwhelmingly in favor against, and it makes this issue headline news all over the world.
Hey, Rabbi, I want to ask my question. It's
important
here. Yeah. There were five people, I
think you said. Signed,
right, five. Yeah. Okay, but there must have been a lot more Reach faculty at that time.
No, no, but these were the leading names.
But these were all, aren't these all, like, relatively junior members of the...
No.
Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Schechter are both...
The only names missing from here are the Rav and Reb David Lifshitz.
And they were both very old.
And they were on in years, and the youth has now taken over. It's a new generation.
So this was understood as a statement of the Reitz faculty.
Of the Reitz faculty, absolutely, 100%. And then you have the issue in Queens, which leads, I want to go further, I don't want to get involved, but this leads to a different question altogether. I had a different opinion, not that my opinion matters, I'm sitting in Israel, but I told when some of the Queens people came in, and, you know, living in Israel, you grow a lot wiser. I have to tell you, when Chazal say, Avira the Ara Machkima, it's very, very true. Somehow when you live in Israel, you live in Jerusalem, you're living in the heart of the Torah world. And you see everything a lot deeper. I don't know, maybe I'm being a little bit supernatural now, but I don't know. I feel the people here, you see the past, the present, the future. It's a different experience. It's Yerushalayim Mir HaKodesh. So I told, when some of the big shots came in from Queens, I said to them, you know, you guys aren't overly smart. I would have ignored, let her take the Torah, let her go into a corner. By making an issue, you turn it into a cause celebre.
What year was it,
Excuse me?
What year,
This has to be the early 90s, I would imagine.
I remember that.
Early 90s. So I told you, Rabbi Holzer differed with me. Man, he gave me a whole argument that the conservative rabbinate was pressing us to take a stand because they were under pressure to give women aliyahs, and if you give in, that the world will say the Orthodox rabbinate prevents women to read from the Torah, then we certainly can give them aliyah. And I said, Manny, forget about the conservative rabbinate, but you created an organization with power now, Jaffa. So many differs with me. A few days later, he says to me, Aaron, you were right. I said, what do you mean I was right? He says, you were totally right. We were foolish to make such a big issue. I said, listen, Manny, don't play games with me. You met with Reb Aaron and Tova the other night, and they told you probably that they have the same viewpoint on you. He said, how'd you know? I said, I have to be a big genius. I know the way they think. So the three of us did agree. Now, I can tell you, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but this has ramifications. You now take what's happened with the women of the wall. Now, these women of the wall, some of them are sincere, some of them are zefa bissen, I don't know how to say that in English, but they're so filled with bitterness, with causticness, with poison against orthodoxy, the rabbinate. I don't know. But, you know, when they started their shtick, Women of the Wall, coming Rosh Chodesh, people asked me what to do. I said, nothing. Ignore them. They're in the women's section. They're not bothering you. They want to sing. They want to read the Torah. Let them do. But people don't listen to me, and it's not the nature. People see someone doing something against Torah, they become kanoim, zealots. So you see what we're up against today as a result of these protests and the Supreme Court and the government of Israel and with all due respects, a very prominent rabbi in America indicated to me he would be very happy if, you know, people listen to my shirm on the website. So they think, if you listen, I've listened occasionally, I hear myself, wow, this guy speaks with such authority, you know, and they're listening. There must be thousands in the shir trying to catch every syllable. Reality is, Rav Kepetz stands on the street corner with a net that you catch fish in, trying to catch people to come to a shir. Take a look, in the kollel, these guys come. It wasn't like this 20, 30, 40 years ago. Today, they come to then, they suddenly have the chutzpah. Years later in the rabbinate, they, oh, our greatest mistake was not going to yeshiva. I told you that they want to console. How can I answer? I don't even know you. So, talk with...
Does this mean that you would have approved a separate section of the synagogue, meaning the Torah?
No, not a separate section of the synagogue. I don't approve anything. But if they're doing it in the women's section, the more you fight them, the more coverage you give them. All you need is to arrest them. And you saw what went on, the whole world, they're threatening Netanyahu, we won't let you come to America, we'll cut you off, we'll cut off money, we'll cut off this, we'll cut off that. If people would like me to speak with Rav Kanievsky, with Rav Steinman, you know, I have to laugh, Halavaya would have the power to speak with them. But this is a real living issue. And it's not so simple how to approach it. I know that the Rav, when it came to synagogue council, and I was more extreme than the Rav, because I was in the rabbinate and I saw what the conservatives have done to Yiddishkeit. But the Rav always would stress that which unites us is more important than that which divides us. My own feeling was that he was one Louis Bernstein side than a David Hollander. Yitzchak, you could agree or disagree. I'm only telling you my own feeling from afar, because I'm living here since 69. But even in the 60s, I felt that to be true. I noticed that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, when there was Yechidit with him, big important people from the United Jewish Appeal, from Banz, and the Rebbe would say to them, "I'm not happy. You got to do more mitzvot. And if you're in a Reform temple, I want you to go every week. And next year, I want to hear you in a conservative temple." And maybe one day I'll hear you in an Orthodox temple. But you notice the Rebbe had a certain breitkeit, a certain broadness. And I have to be honest, when I was younger, I did not have it. I was stupid. I feel very bad because a very prominent Reform rabbi, his two sons, Rabbi Herbert Wein, his two sons, came to daven in my shul on Shabbos. And in my sermon, I ripped the hell out of Reform Judaism. That was not wise. That was a 20-year-old kid speaking with foolishness. I should have, if I had to mention Reform Judaism, I should have spoke. It's a first step towards the beautiful structure of Torah and tradition. We climb the ladder, the same ladder that Yaakov Avinu saw in his dreams. Hasula mutzavatsa. That's a much more mature approach. So I feel very bad. Now, one of those boys I know turned out to be a fine Orthodox Jew, despite Rothkopf. Okay? I don't know about the other boy. And Herbert Wiener, Zichrono Levracha, you know, when he retired, they made a big farewell dinner, and he got up and said, and you know that really in my heart, I have been an Orthodox Jew all these years. And the president responds, Rabbi Wiener, we knew it 30 and 20 years ago that you are really an Orthodox Jew. And all right, you got to give credit. See, the Rebbe, the Rav, be quiet. And I'm not certain they were like this in their youth, particularly the Rav may have been more of a Kanai in his youth. But what he saw in life, you get a lot more with honey than with vinegar. And that's plain and simple. And I go back to what I saw last week. My wife and I still can't get over it. Last night in Haifa, and we're leaving, and the grandchildren dropped us off, and my great-grandson, and here we are approaching the hotel, and it's a part of Haifa where Jews don't even live at night. There's a university dormitory there. Arabs who live by the Haifa Arabs are very different. They're very integrated. It's not like East Jerusalem Arabs. Total different structure there. And it's nicht a brekel Yiddishkeit. No Yiddishkeit there. Their storekeepers would keep pot. I asked them, where do you talk about? They laughed at me. We go, where we live. Neve Shanan, you want shuls. They're all in the Krayot. But here, no, this is just we work here. There's a big government building that's called the Teal, the Missile. In that beautiful building, I understand it's won all types of awards for design, architecture. And in that building, there's a lot of Shvatim work there. So there's a shul in the building. There's Mincha Rolia and there's Marav during the winter as well. All right. And my wife and I love this little boutique hotel that meets all our needs. Clean and large rooms. Oh, perfect, perfect. And it's near the medical school and near a cafe. It's perfect as far as that goes. But nishta brekel Yiddishkeit. And as we're approaching, we see the balloons. And I see guys with beards. And I see inside they're setting up a feast. Wow. Now, who are they going to attract? I want to see a year from now. How much progress will they make? I'm a Litvak. To me, you got to be a Shem a Mitzvah. But no, Chrich, about a different view. One Mitzvah at a time. We don't succeed with the one. But ultimately, you're creating much more Yiddishkeit. So I leave it open. I don't say I'm right. These are very difficult questions. And I'm not going to be able to convince Gafni and Agudat Yisrael and the Belzer Rebbe. They view Reform Judaism as I view it. But I understand in our relations with them, they're a reality. And we have to find a happy ground if we can. Now, I don't know if what I'm about to tell you is really happening or if it's they're just testing the water or it's just a post-Purim joke, but I read over the weekend that the ladies of the wall are planning what's the big event, Chalomoy Pesach, that brings hundreds of thousands to the Jerusalem, brings tens of thousands of guests from Europe, Birchat Kohanim. They are planning Birchat Kohanot, that all the women who have pedigree kohuna in them are going to give a bracha at the Kotel. Is it true or not true? No. And I want to tell you, Avram, I want to tell you, this is not a joke, Yaakov. The Achronim, I dealt with this, I forget already in what context, I dealt with this in the Kollel. The Achronim who are mafalkel on the issue, does a Bat Kohen have a status of Kohuna within her? Some of the Kedusha of a Kohen. A Bat Kohen, she eats Truma. What does this mean? What if you marry a Kohen? Does it transmit to you a status of kahuna? You eat truma. You eat bat kohen from the Kabbalah. It's a very interesting pilpul in the Achronim. And I wonder if the ladies of the wall are aware of this. Okay. Ad Khan, Reb Menashe Kleiner, Reb Heschel Schechter. All right, this is a nice piece. It stands unto itself. It leaves us thinking. But not yet. Yes, Yitzchak.
What happened with Pesach Krauss? Did he give the young girl a place to read the Torah?
Simcha Krauss, not Pesach. Yeah, he gave them the Torah. He's not affected by what other rabbis say. It's his shul. As far as I'm... No. She read the Torah, if I'm not mistaken, downstairs, and they have a... not a base medrash. No. A wedding hall, or upstairs.
Whatever.
That's where they read the Torah, or side room. I mean, they have classrooms there. It wasn't a big deal. They read it. They had a hall elsewhere. I don't know. He gave them a sefer Torah to use. As far as I know, no brachot were recited. She just read it like Kriyat HaMegillah today, which has become so widespread. It's all over the place. What do I think? I would have tried to discourage them if I was the rabbi. But if this crippled woman is insisting and you're caught in the quagmire, I can't criticize him. You understand? There's a difference. L'chatchilan b'diavad. He was caught in a quagmire. This is a balabatim in the shul, wonderful people. The girl's father is in Chabad Satorah from time immemorial, has a wonderful reputation. Her brother's a smokim of the yeshiva, and I believe they're not left wingers at all, as far as I recall. But the mother and daughter wanted this. The rabbi was caught in a quagmire, but you see, what made it more of a firestorm is he already had moved way, way, way from his original beginnings. He was the Talmud Mufhok of Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. He knew Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein from Yeshiva Rabbeinu Chaim in Berlin. If you want, I'll tell you one little story which illustrates what happened in his life. I told it to you, I think I said it in class, maybe years ago, maybe I said it elsewhere. He was rabbi in St. Louis. In St. Louis, he organized the first day school. This goes back many decades. It was the classic question that the Rav had back in 1935. There were a handful of students. You couldn't make it two different schools. If you don't organize co-ed, you will have no day school. Like the Rav began Maimonides. How many students were there? I believe 5. So he asked Rav Kuttner what to do, and he told Rav Kuttner he has to make it mixed. Rav Kuttner was hysterical and told him under no condition. So at that point, Rabbi Krauss begins already, there's a world out there beyond Yeshiva Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin. And this is a problem all of us face. When we so-called broaden, where do we draw the line? And this is the critical issue. This is what's going on with Chofetz Chaim Torah. This is what's going on with Beit Hillel right here in Israel. This is the critical issue. Now, I solved the problem because over the years, I became a bit of a supernatural chassid. So whenever I have a problem, I call Zman, I could talk with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. I had someone I felt totally at home with. But the last years I talk with the Rav, I'm doing better, okay? So to me, the Rav is a very living reality in my life. And I speak with him. I speak with him dafkin Yiddish, not in English. In Bismani, I spoke with him outside of the classroom in English. In the classroom, we spoke Yiddish. But somehow, from listening to all the shayurim over the years on tapes, there's no question that you're not to really understand the Rav Mendafkin Hedonim in Yiddish. And as Tova said, in English, you're right, you're impressed by his English, by his vocabulary, by his accent. But I write down that word for me, I want to check that word out, that's an amazing thing. But in Yiddish, you laugh with him or you cry with him. It's the Rav. It's brisk. It's native. It takes you back 100+ years ago, during the Lusha.
Yes.
Then you can shoot ahead into the future. Okay, that's the way I solved the problem for myself. But the problem is real, and this is so important, the Yerushalmi Shkalim that I used in introduction to the Rav, to my published work on him, that a Talmud has to see his Rebbe as if Bitzel the Rebbe is still alive. He's in his shadow.
What's the source for that?
It's in Shkalim. Look into the Rav, Volume 1, the introduction. You'll see the source. It's Yerushalmi Shkalim. I think it's the end of Perek Bet, but you look in, you'll see. You'll see it. Okay. Gentlemen, we're moving into the big leagues now. On this topic, a very similar topic, Reb Menashe Klein has an entire essay on who is a woman, what is a woman. I will call it the feminine mystique. What's amazing about this essay is that it's written to our friend Dov Frimmer. Now that we know, due to Charlie Hexter, Dr. Hexter in our Monday class filled me in, he's very friendly with Dov from his brother who lives in Rehovot. So it seems when the Frimmers lived in Brooklyn, they had a very close relationship with Reb Menashe Klein. And Dov used to speak with him regularly on various topics, including topics like this that are burning issues. What's amazing here is after I finish Reb Menashe Klein, I'm going to show you the Rav speaking on the very same issue. And there are very strong parallels. Now, with all this being said, remember, Reb Menashe Klein comes from a totally different background. We're dealing here with an Ungarische Talmud Chacham, raised in the general area of the Chatam Sofer, whom he often always quotes. We're dealing here with an individual who went through the hell of the Holocaust. And you got to remember, there are many survivors of the Holocaust, but one thing I learned at a very young age, you can't say all the survivors went through the same torture. There were those that fought with the partisans hidden forest. There were those that hid in barns. And there were those that went through the hell of the death camps, of the crematorians, and all that goes with it. He went through the absolute hell. To add to that, you now know his own family situation. And there's no question that what he suffered with his first marriage certainly leaves a lasting impression on his soul. And we're going to come to that not only this year, but in years to come when we deal with some very delicate issues in Eben HaEsa, you'll see where he's coming from. With all that being said, it's very fascinating to see how he handles this question. And just let me start it briefly. We're quoting from Mishnah Halachot, Volume 17, Siman 92, Tzadi Bet. Hashkafet HaTorah b'inyan shivyan zkuyot l'nashim u'bidvar asiyat minyan l'nashim. We're dealing with, and he hits the nail on the head. What do we mean by equal rights? The heart of feminism, making their own minyanim. This tshuva was written in 1986. And it's written to Mala Kavod Yedidi V'Rab Habibi. See, he knows Dov Frimmer, my good friend. Harav Hagon Kavod Shem Tifato Harav Yisachar Dov Frimmer Shlita. Achadrishat Shlom Kvod Tifato. This is elegant rabbinic expressions. After asking how your royal Torah personality is, I want you to know that your wonderful letter reached me yesterday. And even though I'm very busy and I don't have the time to write a long answer, nevertheless, I took off all the time from all that I was doing and I knocked out the time to clarify what I spoke to you about orally when we last met, because I'm very worried no one should misunderstand my words, and therefore I am writing to you this lengthy tshuva to be absolutely clear. Now look at the date. We're talking 1986. Look what's going on here. This is exactly when Reb Heschel Schechter's tshuva 84, 85 makes the rounds. This is when the feminist issue is exploding. I'll tell you what else is fascinating in this tshuva, and I'll give you, we'll hit it when we do the tshuva. He gives here klalim in psak. When can you be mekil? When can you be samach on a dat yachid? He, very powerful, kala kavod to this individual, an ungadisha, a Talmud of the Chatam Sofa, Borough Park, Brooklyn, all that goes with it. And yet he's taking on an issue that is causing havoc in the modern Orthodox world, of which Dov Frimer is a son, a grandson of that world. His father's a musmach of Chicago, what you call Skokie. Norman Frimer was a well-known American rabbi involved in outreach in B'nai B'rith. The rabbi Washington, that building was once taken over by Arab terrorists, and he was caught in the building. It's a well-known family. And Dov is a YU product. And here he is on intimate terms with Reb Menashe Klein. Gentlemen, what did we do today? We finished out the Pasha Shech, we finished out the Tshuva, we finished out the five names, the four who co-signed with him, the impact, the era, and now Reb Menashe Klein. But this time Reb Menashe Klein is not serving as an introduction to Reb Heschel Schechter, he's serving as an introduction to Mori Urebi Hagon Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. Tomorrow is a very crucial lecture, Sheur. We're finishing out the controversy. I'm showing you why the Dan Nitzan, why that became so important at that moment. The fallout in Chabad, how a secular Jew views it. I'm dealing with the criticism of Barry, and I want to give you some life insight tomorrow that goes beyond Barry's witticism and criticism. And then Be'ezrat Hashem, we're sailing into the next topic, messianism, no holds barred, as you will see. Yitzchak, this is for you. Pass it back. This is really something. Gentlemen, why Hank Greenberg never became a New York Yankee. I am proud to say that Aaron Rakefet was absolutely right. I always wondered, how could my father's friend, remember, my father and Hank grew up around the corner from each other. How come he went to the Tigers? You know why he went to the Tigers? Because Hank Greenberg had a Yiddish cup. The Yankees invited him for a tryout. Their tongues were out for him. He would have brought in every Jew in New York, would have gone to the Yankee games. No, absolutely not. You know why he went? They offered him a contract, everything, a bonus. Because he saw Lou Gehrig at first base and he said, I'm never going to succeed that guy. He's the greatest. The Yankees figured they'll turn him into an outfielder. He looked around. Detroit didn't have a good first baseman. That's why he went to Detroit. I was absolutely right. Gentlemen, another article on A League of Their Own, the Jewish Baseball Museum with a beautiful inscribed baseball. Wow. An article today. The famous Jewish ball players in the major leagues. I take that with you. And it's together. And one of them is a manager of he's the manager of the Tigers, and he was just thrown out of the game on Shabbos. And you know why he was thrown out? He shouldn't be Machal of Shabbos. That's why I figured they threw him out. This is the German historian accuses AP of Nazi collaboration with pictures here. God, it's the whole Associated Press. Here's an unbelievable story in Egypt, and one of the ancient artifacts, they found a Magen David. And you got to see the response, but they're going to research it. This is good news from the
eye. No, it wasn't until the 1500s.
They found, take a look what they found. So some Jews, some Egyptian scholars claim it was put there by Jews who were visiting. The Ethiopian brigade commander, could you imagine, there is now a Lieutenant Colonel Avi Yitzchak, head of the combat medical branch, the first Ethiopian to graduate the Army's prestigious course for brigade commanders. They should put a picture of this up in Harlem. Here you have a Orthodox female rabbi, Lily Kagagin, who's calling herself rabbi. Here Moshe Schwartz sent me an article on Steve Bain and Porat, what we spoke about in class. Here is a very interesting article from the New York Times on Saudi Arabia. They have a special surgical department that specializes in separating Siamese twins. Very beautiful, moving article. Halavai, they should be successful. New York Times, the big problem with baseball, we don't have enough Afro-Americans in it. It's all white today, and the Afro-Americans all go into basketball and football, and the kids are more. Baseball today is the third sport in America, which is a disgrace to someone like myself, raised at a time that there was only baseball.
The black kids that finally, I go to the school where I taught thought that baseball was the most boring game in the world.
I explained that to my wife. The only, and here, I explained it to my wife yesterday.
It wasn't no part of baseball.
Here is the New York Times on protests in baseball, seldom upheld. You know what happened the other day? That guy ran within the baseline, obviously. And the Yankee pitcher, instead of throwing to first base, and he threw over it, it was a wild throw, should have thrown at the person and hit his back, and he would have been called out with interference. Ugh, it's good
the
to
be... The game was reversed.
This was never protested. The article has it, but it's rarely reversed when it's a protest. It's not looking at the camera again. My dear students, I want to thank you very much for joining me. Tomorrow will be our last day before Matzah overtakes us. We pick up again a week after Pesach, not the Sunday, Monday after Pesach, but 1 week later. The Kollel begins that Tuesday, not Sunday, Monday, until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya.